Sangye chutang suki chunam la Changchu bardu dagni kyab suchi Dagi jin sogi bisonam gi Dola penjir sangye du parshu. I go for refuge until I am enlightened, to the Buddha's Dharma and the assembly of saints, and the virtuous merits that I collect by the practice of giving and the other perfections, may I attain the state of a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened, to the Buddha's Dharma and the assembly of saints, and the virtuous merits that I collect by the practice of giving and the other perfections, may I attain the state of a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. May all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all beings never be separated from the bliss which is sorrowless. May all dwell in equanimity, free from aversion and clinging. The ground is covered with flowers and sprinkled with scented water. In the middle is Mount Meru,
surrounded by the four continents and ornamented by the sun and the moon.
By visualizing all this and offering it as a Buddha ground,
may all sentient beings
partake of the Buddha's pure lands. Om Guru Buddha Bodhisattva Saparivara Ratnamanda Buddha Mega Samudra Saparana Samaye.
Okay, welcome to tonight's teaching, Parting from the Four Attachments. As we've said before, there have been written lots and lots of commentaries in the last 1,000 years or so. And there's basically two types. One is sort of academic, intellectual approach, and the other is what's called a song of experience, which is basically a spontaneous expression by somebody who's had deep realization. In this case, it's Jetsun Drapa Gyaltsen. We decided to start with this book because it's so amazing and it's so different. But that doesn't mean we're going to ignore the other types of commentaries. If I make reference to Drapa Gyaltsen, that's because we're starting out with that, but that doesn't mean that this will be our only source. Also, his approach to commenting on this teaching is quite different. He starts out, we've covered this in the last couple of classes, talking about listening, contemplation, and meditation, but that those three need to be preceded by morality. And he actually spends quite a bit of time talking about why that's so and why it's so important. And he really talks about two different types of moral conduct. We already covered the first one, which is what I call common morality. He doesn't name it, but it's just avoiding the 10 non-virtuous actions, basically. So that's not only Buddhists have that. I mean, that's just being a good human being, is not to go around lying, stealing, and killing, and so on. And then there's a second part, and again, he doesn't give a name, but I have, just to have a name, I call it pseudo-morality. And there are two types of pseudo-morality. The first type, covered last week, the 8 worldly concerns, which I have renamed the 4 poisonous dichotomies. And we talked about why and how they're not really concerns, they're poisons. So that's one type. And he says, Drapa Gyaltsen says, without morality, nothing is possible. But if it is observed out of attachment to this life, you have the root cause of the 8 worldly poisons. So remember, the first attachment is attachment to this life. So he kind of eases us into the first line of the 4 attachments by talking about morality. And just for interest's sake, I have a different translation of that, what I just read, and you'll see that there's kind of another way of saying it according to the translator, who says, quoting Drapa Gyaltsen, "Though there is no method for gaining liberation without depending upon moral conduct, the moral conduct of one attached to this life is endowed with the root that accomplishes the 8 worldly poisons. Put aside this type of moral conduct." So that's one type of false morality. The second type is actually what he calls false moral conduct. And that's what we're going to talk about tonight a bit. And this is where I think it gets interesting, because it really dives down into morality that we might not necessarily think about, but we can fall into as practitioners if we don't think about it. So that's why it's really important for us to get this part, because it really affects our practice. In fact, he says it'll drive you to the lower realms. So it's not to be messed with. Chogyi Trichen Rinpoche's commentary on Drapa Gyaltsen's commentary says, "How does impure morality function in the experience of a practitioner? One afflicted by the 8 worldly poisons will only be able to partially follow precepts due to improper motivation and misguided intentions. This corrupts one's own behavior while at the same time making one judgmental, critical, and even jealous of the conduct of others." So we're going to see some examples of how that works. He says, one example would be that a person might maintain a set of vows, but at the same time make disparaging remarks such as, "Oh, those people, they've taken vows, but they don't keep them very carefully, and they certainly have let themselves down. However, my own conduct is really exemplary." Now, that might sound like kind of an exaggeration, but we need to be careful, because a lot of this kind of happens sort of underneath our awareness. You know, we can have stuff going on that maybe we're not tuned into. And then he goes on to say, "Faulting the behavior of others through demeaning comments, while at the same time finding ways to praise one's own behavior, is one fine example that indicates a defiled or insincere practice of morality." And of course, there's variations on that theme. Another variation would be to look down on the transgressors who are inferior, but to then manifest jealousy towards those who actually keep superior morality. And that would sound like, well, I suppose they keep their vows, but they haven't really studied or meditated. And then if you want to take it to an extreme case, that would be when we have being really jealous of people who keep morality well. And that would sound like, oh, well, they seem to keep the precepts, but, and then go on and list some kind of defect that this other person has, and then you proceed into slander. Then you have a real problem, because you've committed 2 non-virtues. So it's really important that we not slide into that. A superficial practitioner may find themselves unable to tolerate a moral person and feel compelled to look for faults or to even make them up. Famous sour grapes. Chogyi Trichen Rinpoche gives another example. One may try to place doubts in the minds of people who would otherwise respect a moral person due to their faithful adherence to the precepts. One whose morality is artificial is always looking for an excuse to put someone else down. They will always find something to criticize. And such a person will be much more concerned with judging the conduct of others than in guarding and protecting their own conduct. People like this will never find anyone to inspire their pursuit of virtue, but at the same time will never fail to find someone to disparage. These are the sorts of results that come from the insincere practice of morality, and we would do well to avoid them. Again, that was Chogyam Trichen Rinpoche said that. Another example would be a person who has artificial morality being very critical towards those who don't practice any morality. So a person with false morality may be very judgmental and condescending towards those who make even small mistakes. A person with false morality may tend to chastise others for the terrible weight of their sins. And a person with false morality will be neither understanding, nor forgiving, nor compassionate, since the morality of a person with false morality will be practiced in order to attract respect, gain, and happiness for themselves in this life alone. So all of these are example of a lack of pure motivation and intent. Another type of impure morality is hypocrisy. And again, Chogyam Trichen Rinpoche says, hypocrisy is another very common way that impure morality manifests. An example of this kind of hypocrisy that we may be familiar with is when people keep pure moral conduct while in the company of others, but when others are absent, they may do whatever they wish without any concern for their moral discipline. Those who practice impure morality may make a show of virtuous conduct in front of others, even though they are not actually maintaining the moral discipline. This is because they are very worried about how others perceive them, how they appear to others. This is inauthentic practice, as it is under the power of the 8 worldly poisons. So we see this reference again and again to the 8 worldly poisons. And he goes on to say, one who practices moral conduct for this world alone will accumulate in this way a stockpile of hypocrisy. Such morality is in reality more a cause for rebirth in the lower realms than it is for liberation. It's only if one's practice of morality is genuine and pure, that is to say, free from hypocrisy, that it becomes a cause for happiness as well as a cause for the attainment of all the levels of enlightenment. In fact, most people's morality does suffer from exactly this sort of superficiality and hypocrisy. This means that we may actually be focused on this life's welfare, chasing after fame, honor, respect, personal gain, and so on. But no matter how upright we may appear, as long as we are ensnared in these 8 worldly poisons, we will never be free. Since the practice of hypocritical morality actually ends up creating causes for one to be born in the 3 lower realms, it should be avoided at any cost. Practicing morality with worldly motives is likened to falling in a pit. Hence, it is quite useful to know these things. And whatever practice we may do, if it is according to or conditioned by the 8 worldly poisons, it's actually better for us to just abandon it as soon as possible, as it is quite harmful. On the other hand, whatever practice we follow that is truly in accord with Dharma instructions, we should stay with, by all means. True morality and virtue must be completely free of the 8 worldly poisons. Would it not be better to be free of hypocrisy, especially since it serves no purpose? Jetsun Drapa Gyaltsen is telling us that it is necessary to give up hypocritical morality. Hypocritical morality can easily lead to judging and finally abusing others. And this is certain to result in an unhappy future. If you discover this kind of hypocrisy in yourself, give it up immediately. Chogyam Trichen Rinpoche, in his commentary, goes in quite extensive discussion about to not make the mistake of thinking that a small behavior sort of doesn't count. Oh, it's a small thing, it's not that important, I don't have to worry about it, I don't need to pay attention to it. That is a huge mistake. Because as we know from our previous studies, karma multiplies, and it's better to think of it as multiplying 100 times than to think, oh, this is a little small thing that didn't really matter. And Rinpoche quotes a very famous story, which is the story of Elapatra. And this is actually from the sutras. The story goes that the Buddha, of course, had monastic disciples. They weren't all monastics, but he had monastic disciples. And he didn't really lay down a bunch of rules. The way it developed is when something would happen, when somebody would do something, people would come to the Buddha and say, well, you know, is that okay or not? And he would say, well, no, not really. And then he would make a rule, don't do that. It wasn't like he just had his commandments written in advance. So what happened was, the story doesn't really say how this developed, but the Buddha made the rule that monastics could not uproot trees or just randomly pull out grass. They were forbidden from doing that. That's one of the rules, still today, I guess. And one of his disciples was named Elapatra, and Elapatra thought this was silly. And he was like, oh, come on, you know, what's the difference? It's just a bunch of grass, it's just a tree, what's the difference? Yeah, don't worry about it. And he disregarded the rule. Well, karmically speaking, he was reborn as a Naga. Now, we talked about Nagas quite a bit last summer, but without going into a lot of details, Nagas are a type of being, and they're interesting because they're unusual. They are typically rendered as half human and half snake. Bottom half being snake and the top half being human. But actually, it seems that they have, at least some of them anyway, have an ability to shapeshift and actually appear as humans or appear as animals, and they seem to have this ability that's kind of fluid. And in fact, they are fluid beings in the sense that they tend to live in water or the sap of trees, which is liquid, and they're sort of half animals, and they're hard to kind of pin down because they kind of change. But in any case, Elapatra was born as a Naga, but he had a gigantic tree growing out of the top of his head because of the disrespect that he showed to the Buddha and his rule about not pulling up trees. And this tree that Elapatra had was really big. And so when the wind blew, it, you know, pulled him over, and it was like really painful. He had these massive headaches, or if there was wind or there was rain or there was, you know, any kind of environmental disturbance, he really, really suffered. And he basically came back to the Buddha and said, sorry, I was wrong, you were right. But the point of the story is to don't think that because something is small that it doesn't matter. We should really pay attention to morality. By the way, the same thing is true of positive karma, too. Don't think that a small good deed is not much. That's not true either. So it's better to think that things multiply and that everything counts and not disregard small things, whether they're good or bad. So those are some of the categories and some of the examples of the different types of morality that Drapa Gyaltsen is talking about here. But he goes even further talking about it, because he wants to now apply morality to hearing, contemplation, meditation. So you can see he's spending a lot of time, and this is a very short commentary, by the way. He spends a lot of the commentary talking about this. So now he wants to apply it to those three things, starting with hearing and contemplation, which he groups together. And sometimes these are grouped together and they're called study. So if you hear a reference to study, it means hearing and contemplation grouped together. But first, Drapa Gyaltsen wants to talk about the qualities of hearing and contemplation before he tells you about applying morality to it. So what he says is that the person who performs hearing and contemplation is endowed with the wealth of accumulating knowledge, the lamp that dispels ignorance, the knowledge of the path that leads living beings, and the seed of the Dharmakaya. Let's go through those different ones and see what those mean. So the first one, the wealth of accumulating knowledge, refers to the knowledge and the power of the path of Dharma and how to navigate the path, how to avoid the downfalls, how to practice skillful means, and how to speed up progress on the path. Skillful means being one of the ways of speeding up your progress. So that's the wealth of accumulating knowledge. Geshe Thashi Namgyel said, listening and thinking about Dharma is a good job. If you get more Dharma knowledge, then you'll have more power. Now, obviously, he meant pure power in the sense of the power to be skillful in your practice, to attain enlightenment in order to help sentient beings. That's the kind of power he was referring to, obviously. Not impure, corrupted power. Second one is the lamp that dispels ignorance. We talked last time about the proper attitude of listening, where we need to admit that we have the disease of self-cherishing, that the Buddha is the doctor, the Dharma is the medicine, our practice is taking the cure. And we need to light the lamp that dispels ignorance by hearing and contemplating, and then integrate that through meditating one-pointedly, the three steps that we're always talking about. And Geshe Thashi Namgyel's famous quote was, well, the Buddha appeared 2,600 years ago, why aren't you enlightened yet? The next one is the knowledge of the path that leads living beings. So this is a Mahayana great vehicle teaching, so it's a given that our motivation is to attain enlightenment for the sake of all beings. That's what we're here for. That's the motivation. Or at least it should be, anyway. And this actually points to the third line in the Parting from the Four Attachments, which is, if you have attachment to your own purpose, you do not have the enlightenment thought. In other words, you're not a bodhisattva. And then the final one is, study plants the seed of the Dharmakaya. That points to the fourth line, if grasping arises, you do not have the view. One way of looking at perfect enlightenment is that the Buddhas have attained the correct view. About what? About the true nature of reality. And about the two kinds of selflessness, the selflessness of self and the selflessness of phenomena. And the fully enlightened beings are the only ones who have attained that. In other words, they are the one with the correct view. Of course, view is a word. It's a label. And the Dharmakaya is beyond description. It's beyond labels of any kind. It's beyond any concepts. So we should keep that in mind, that we're using words that are imperfect here. But to attain that, we need to study. When Buddhas attain the realization of the true nature of reality, in other words, when that view is realized, Buddhas obtain what is called the truth body, which is one of the different translations of Dharmakaya. And Drapa Gyaltsen says that hearing and contemplation contain the seed of Dharmakaya. So we all have Buddha nature, which is the potential, but we need to actualize it. How? Listening, contemplation, meditation. That's how we actualize it. So until we do that, it's just it's a potential, but it's kind of latent, I guess you could say. And clarifying the sage's intent goes into some detail about this, where they actually say there's two kinds of Buddha nature. There's this potential that every being has, but it's sort of theoretical in a way, in the sense that the other type is beings that have the proclivity towards spirituality. Those are the beings that actually get on the path and go through all the stages and become enlightened. And Sakyapandita makes a pretty big distinction between those types of Buddha nature, because it, on the one hand, one is just, it's not dormant, but it's quite inactive until you actually get on the path and actualize it. Chogyi Trichen Rinpoche says, we ought to study Dharma properly and with great intent, unstained by attachment to our own welfare and honor in this life, and with intention to liberate ourselves from such attachments. If we learn and study in this way, then this process of study becomes the skillful means of acquiring the splendor and wealth of knowledge. One will find that one becomes truly contented through the knowledge that one has acquired. For those who study with proper intentions, anything they may learn will serve to dispel the darkness of ignorance and confusion that they may be experiencing in their own lives. This is because whatever they study, they will apply to themselves. And this will alleviate the sufferings that afflict them. Anything such people may study will further serve to humble and ennoble them, increasing their clarity, their brilliance, their knowledge, and their wisdom. So, genuine study is the basis for attaining enlightenment, a cause for oneself finally to attain the state of Dharmakaya, the wisdom body of truth or reality. So the qualities of hearing and contemplation, if the acquisition of knowledge progresses to clear discernment and great conviction, this is still Chogyi Trichen Rinpoche. If the acquisition of knowledge progresses to clear discernment and great conviction, then not only does this dispel one's own negativities and confusion, but it can also serve as a torch that can light the way for others, guiding them safely while helping them to avoid darkened byways. Genuine knowledge eliminates the slumber of mental darkness by the light that is lit within one's being through authentic study. Through proper study, you're able to discern the ultimate nature of reality, as well as to understand the actual condition of everything and everyone around you. Proper study provides you with a mirror that allows you to perceive very clearly many things that otherwise you would have no way of knowing. It's through hearing and study and learning about the Dharma that one discovers the possibility of oneself becoming a Buddha. And although we all have the qualities of a Buddha, the seed of Buddha, lying dormant within us, we normally do not appreciate this fact. By learning and studying the Dharma, we come to appreciate our potential, and this infuses us with a newfound feeling of hope and possibility. And this causes us to reevaluate our lives, discovering a value and a meaning in life that would have remained hidden from us had we not entered into learning and study. And then he says, another great benefit of knowledge acquired through proper study that is pursued with sincere intentions is that one becomes able to allay fears and anxieties in oneself and others. With proper motivation, the more knowledge one acquires, the more fear and insecurity one will be able to eliminate. The more fear you're able to dispel, the more you are able to increase the happiness of others, as well as your own sense of well-being. And so learning is not just a chore undertaken to acquire knowledge. It is in itself something enjoyable, something that brings satisfaction to oneself and can benefit others. Drakpa Gyaltsen says in his Song of Experience commentary, though there is no method for gaining liberation without depending upon hearing and contemplation, the hearing and contemplation of one attached to this life are endowed with pride, contempt for inferiors in hearing and contemplation, seeking followers and wealth, and it's the root which attains the lower realms. Put aside this kind of hearing and contemplation of the eight worldly poisons. Chogyi Trichen Rinpoche said, when one studies or meditates, if one is actually just interested in this life's welfare, willing to appear to others as a great practitioner, then this is artificial practice. In fact, such an approach defeats the whole purpose of following the Dharma. Wouldn't it be better not to go through so much trouble for nothing? On the other hand, properly motivated study definitely dispels mental darkness, and meditation, approached correctly, certainly deepens spiritual realization. Whatever you study, it is necessary to examine, analyze, and contemplate in order to clarify all your doubts and questions. The depths of conviction that you gain from such study and contemplation remains very deeply seated within you, setting a firm basis for further realization. Having clarified all your major doubts and questions, it's necessary to continue to progress and deepen your understanding by following the practice of meditation. Pure moral conduct means to practice according to the instructions of the tradition. I'm going to repeat that. Pure moral conduct means to practice according to the instructions of the tradition. Authentic moral conduct means that one has excellent intention of keeping one's moral discipline until reaching enlightenment, with the motivation of benefiting all sentient beings. So all of that is regarding the qualities and the pitfalls of listening and contemplation and doing it either correctly or incorrectly. Any questions?
All of this that you've been talking about, does this just apply to Buddhists?
This?
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean, does it just apply to Buddhists? Other people can go and do these poisons and not have any effect?
The whole part about hypocrisy. Other religions don't feel that what they're doing is being hypocritical.
Uh-huh.
So there's quite a conflict there. So does like to us, it's obvious that what someone is doing is, according to this, is being hypocritical. But to another religion, to them, it's not being hypocritical.
Yeah. Interesting question. I think it's important to remember that Buddha did not come on the earth to found Buddhism and start a religion. He came to seek the truth. Basically, what is reality? How are things really? Mm-hmm. Having said that, he also recognized that there's a whole lot of different kinds of people and beings and a lot of different personalities and proclivities and tendencies and so on. And that's why he taught so many different kinds of teachings himself, and there's so many different kinds of paths. It's not really about is it Buddhist or not? It's about is it true or not? Is it the truth or not? And truth is relative in the sense of what we see is relative, but the absolute truth isn't relative, it's absolute. It's beyond religion, it's beyond words even. From a Buddhist point of view, we would never say to anybody else, oh, your religion's wrong. We wouldn't say that, we shouldn't say that. However, we are responsible for our own examination of what is true. You don't get a pass. You got to do the work. So if you feel that what Buddha said resonates for you and you follow it, you know, with sincere motivation, then you have a good path. But that's not to say that somebody else can't have a different path. There's plenty of good people around that are not Buddhists. So we can't say it's only true for Buddhists, because that's really not true. But we also can't say, well, you have to take our version of the truth. We don't do that either. We don't proselytize. So it's kind of a tricky question in a way. It's a really interesting question, though. But the bottom line is we're responsible for our own practice and our own listening, contemplation, and meditation.
But does that mean, okay, we would be building up quite a lot of bad karma? So, like, where my question came from was looking at the Muslims, how the woman has to wear a burqa so that she doesn't, what's the word I want? So that she doesn't... Well, so the men aren't the woman has to wear a burqa, but the men can dress comfortably, and it's a hot area. So, and if she takes her burqa off, then she can be shot. Now, is that not hypocrisy? Are the men then not building up a lot of bad karma?
Okay, again, this is an interesting question because it's complicated. First of all, the result of karma always depends on motivation, and we can never judge the motivation of another person. So we're not in a position to judge it and say, that's bad karma, what they're doing. We would say, we wouldn't do that, but it's not our job to judge other people. It's our job to mind our own practice and behavior. You know, there's the famous story of the Buddha who actually killed somebody. Well, looking from the outside, that's a violation of one of the fundamental laws of morality, not to kill. But there was an exceptional circumstance, and he had an exceptional motivation, and he did it. In that case, it was actually meritorious. But you wouldn't know that unless you knew the motivation. So, human beings, a lot of human beings, are really good at pointing out the faults of others. And maybe not so good for, you know, looking at our own faults. I mean, even Jesus talked about that. So, in the case that your example, whatever I may or may not think, it's not my job to judge it. It's my job to reflect back to myself and say, now, what are my values, what are my morals, and am I taking care of my own situation? And in fact, that's what I do all the time when I see something going on and somebody's doing something. I say, okay, I see that out there, but how does that reflect back on me? Where am I maybe doing that, or maybe fudging a little bit? And I always try to bring it back. Because if you're always focused out there, well, they're doing that wrong and they're doing that wrong, there's no end to it, you know. I don't know. Does that answer you?
Well, I guess, you know, but, you know, if we always just mind our own business, then there's always going to be trouble in the world.
Well, that doesn't mean you can't intervene in a situation where you can really help a situation. If somebody was being stabbed, I would try to stop it. I wouldn't just say, well, you shouldn't do that. But you've got to, every situation has to be, you know, evaluated individually. The best way to solve the problems in the world is to get enlightened. That's when you really can help. Mm-hmm. Right now, we're kind of, our hands are tied pretty much. I mean, really, how much can you really help? Really. It's limited. And we all want world peace, but, you know. What did the Buddha teach? Don't do harm. If you can, do good. Train your mind. That's what he taught. First of all, you don't do the bad stuff that you're seeing others do. Secondly, if you are able to in some way help a situation, yes, of course, of course. I mean, I've done first aid on people on the street a few times. But it's limited, you know. I can't fix all their problems, and, you know, Dharma is the solution, is the long-term solution. In the meantime, you do the best you can, mm-hmm. without judging and without pointing fingers all the time, because you never, there's no end to that. Mm-hmm. Okay? Thank you. Interesting question. I mean, it's an important question, I think. Any other questions people have about this? Okay, so let's do a short meditation on what we talked about. Okay, so find a comfortable posture for you and your body. And if you want to take a couple of breaths just to transition from all of these words into a meditative state. So tonight, our good karma has ripened, and we have been fortunate to receive ancient wisdom regarding our attachments and how to be free from them. And specifically about the importance of morality as the fertile soil which can grow the seeds of listening, contemplation, and meditation. And we've heard about the different kinds of morality: common morality, false morality, and all the different variations that there can be and how we need to be attentive with our own practice, that we don't slip into false morality without maybe even realizing it. And ending up harming our practice, maybe even harming others. So we have a chance now to study, think about, contemplate, and now meditate on these topics so that the meaning goes in deep inside of us and changes our life for the better. And as such, also the lives of those around us. Because that's our motivation, is to benefit all beings. I'll say the dedication. Song on the Don Jazzy Pani Dognani Pedanam Pajiti Kegana Jibalung Tupayi Sipetso Vedu Arushok Jang Zem Jen Ke panam vigyujik Ke anyam parne paryam Gong ne gong du pel purshu Jam pa pa oi ji tar ken badam Kun du song po de yang de jin de De da kung yi jesu da lo che Ge wa di da tam che ra tu ngô Tu sung shek pi kya wa tam che ki Nyu wa ngang wa cho tu ngā pa gi Dakshin ge be sa wa di kum chang Sang po chu chi rab du ngu war gi Chak sa wa dang jo jing sha pa dang Yesu yi rang gu jing so wa yi Ge chung ze da gi chi sak pa tam je zo pe jang chu chi By the Spirit, may all attain omniscience. May it defeat the enemy wrongdoing. From the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death. From the ocean of samsara, may all beings be free. Bodhicitta is precious. May it arise in all beings in whom it has not arisen. May it never decline where it has arisen, but may it ever grow and flourish. In whatever way, valiant Manjushri and Samanta Bhadra know how to transfer merit, so do I dedicate all my own virtues, that I might train to be like them. Through this dedication, praise the Supreme, by the victorious Buddhas of the past, present, and future, I, together with all sentient beings, dedicate these roots of virtue to attaining Buddhahood. May whatever little virtue I may have gained from prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, requesting, and beseeching, be dedicated to attaining perfect enlightenment.
Thank you.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Michael.